All right, this is Saturday. We are about to begin session number 7. We did 3 hours on Thursday night, and we did 3 hours yesterday, and that's only halfway through. We have 6 hours to go today. And so streaming is going on at BufordCoc.com. I converted all the files last night, but I didn't get to load them video-wise. I'll try to work on that later today. But all the audio from the first 2 days is already up. And the video from the first day that I'm recording, what Lyle's doing is to stream, is another thing. But all this material will be up. So I don't want to review much of what we've done before. I'm just going to start at the beginning of the slides that I first did. And we'll go from there. All the material is going to be located at this site, thebible.net/GSOP/between the testaments. If you just go to thebible.net/GSOP, you'll get a directory of other classes that I taught. Church history class I taught, Isaiah, but you'll also see the directory. So if you don't remember all of that, just thebible.net/GSOP will get you to where you need to be. I mentioned that these are some of the books. I realized I had knocked one off the top, and there's one other that's not in there. So there's two others that I worked through in part to do some of this stuff. Bibliography, copy of this is on the site. So everything that we presented, just about, I think, I'll have to double check, is already up. This is the bibliography that we used. And this is the order of things that we've already studied, and I'll bring us up to where we are and then where we're going. And so after we did the introductory material, we started to talk about the return of the Jewish exiles from Babylonian captivity. Right before that, we used the Bible period chart to survey from creation all the way through the end of the book of Revelation. And then we backed up and started explaining how it was that the period of known as the intertestamental period kicked into gear. And so it's going to kick in the gear following these periods in history that we're discussing or have already discussed. So we talked about the Jewish exiles returning. We talked about the work of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, especially Ezra and Nehemiah, as Jerusalem was rebuilt. The temple was rebuilt. The walls of the city were rebuilt. The system of worship that was first started by Moses nearly 1,000 years before was restarted. So that big redo that we talked about. And then we talked about moving out of the period of the restoration and into technically the period in between the testaments or the intertestamental period. And we started with Alexander the Great. We talked about his incredible expansion in the short time that he lived. He only lived 32, 33 years. But we also talked about the lingering influences that came about because of his Hellenization or the spread of Greek culture to the world that he dominated and came to control. An influence that existed long beyond his life. His generals kept that up, and we saw how that became problematic going forward, especially with the influence of the Ptolemies, one of the generals who controlled Egypt and their successors, and the Seleucids, one of the generals that controlled Syria and their successors. They both continued that emphasis on spread of Greek culture. So we saw one of the negative consequences of Antiochus IV, who was one of the Seleucid successors, pushing Greek culture to the extent that he forbade the Jews to worship in the temple, forbade worship of God, instituted pagan sacrifices in the temple, converted it to a temple worshiping the Greek god Zeus, which is part of their pantheon of gods, and desecrated the temple by offering a pagan sacrifice, an animal at that point, and then insisted that everybody who was in the land would have to follow this new religion and couldn't do what they used to do. And that caused a lot of problems, to say the least. And this was the breakout of a war against that we ended with yesterday.
Antiochus.
Or Antiochus, yeah. And there's a bunch of them.
That's who the Antioch of Syria is named after? Am I making a wrong
assumption? Well, there was, and I don't know which one came first, but there was an Antioch in Syria at this time that was a prominent city. So I'm not sure which came first. The names Antiochus or Antiochus were a series of rulers that all bore the same name, okay. Like Ptolemies.
Right.
And so which came first, I'm not sure of. But yeah, they are connected.
Because you got the Antioch of Pisidia too.
So. That's right. You have two different ones. Yeah, this was a different one. But that was one of the prominent cities in Syria where the Seleucids. Remember, Seleucus Nicator was the first guy who had that name. He was one of four major generals that. Served under Alexander the Great, and the only reason why we're focusing on two is those are the two that were opposite sides of the land of Palestine being in the middle. The Ptolemies in Egypt, Syria over here, and every time I do that it looks backwards when you're looking at it. So here's Egypt, here's Syria, and Palestine's in the middle.
Right.
And those two generals and their successors were constantly bickering back and forth and vying for control, not only in their immediate area and nations surround them, but especially that middle land of Palestine. So lots of stuff was going on there. So because of the over-the-top influence that Antiochus IV Epiphanes considered himself a manifestation of the presence of God, was that nickname attributed to him. Because of that over-the-top influence, he just ruined the Jewish system. And people fled Jerusalem and they went into hiding. Well, some emissary came to the town of Modin, M-O-D-E-I-M, where Mattathias and his sons were, and they tried to compel the people there to be involved in pagan worship. And they tried to get Mattathias to do so because he was a leading person. He said, if you do this, everybody else will comply, and you'll be okay, and everything will go good with you. And he says, I'm not going to do it. One of the Jews who was attempting to do that was going to comply with them. Mattathias killed him. He killed the emissary that came from Antiochus, and that started a civil war. All right, not a civil war because it wasn't between two factions within the same country, but it started a war between the Maccabeans, name for that we'll explain in a second, the family of Mattathias, and the forces of the Seleucids, Antiochus. And so that war broke out, and that goes on for a long time. They finally run them out of town. They finally take back the system of worship and so forth. And we see the rededication of the temple. And following that, so the Maccabees, that's the name of Judas Maccabeus, the hammer. He was a son of Mattathias. The Hasmoneans, that was the name of his grandfather, Mattathias. So they're referring to two different parts of the same family, one the grandfather and the other one a great-grandson. But they're the same people. So from that point going forward, the descendants of Mattathias, Judas and Jonathan and Simon, they become priests, and later some of their family members assume the right of king. So you've got lots of weird dynamics going on here, and for 115 years the Hasmoneans run the land of Israel. And so this is an interesting thing. They started with good purposes. The good purpose was to get rid of these people oppressing them and not letting them worship as they wanted to. But over a period of time, they got involved in more problems than what they were trying to root out in the first place. So we are going to take up today what the Romans are coming. All right. We saw influence of Rome at the very end of our lesson yesterday, and then we're going to take up with the rule of Herod because that's very, very close to what's going on in the New Testament. Now, we want to, and we're not going to get as much into this as I would like, dealing with the nature of Scripture that develops. And I say Scripture that develops, the word Scripture just means writing. And so we're going to ask and answer the question about what is Scripture biblically speaking and compare it to some of these things generally. We're not going to have much time to go into all the detail. And I said if we had time we would mention some of these things with reference to the key players, and we're only going to mention those in passing. There's just so much material to get into. So let's get in to the material. So rather than going through the written material that I've done before and later, I'm not going to zoom out of this real fast and go here. I think it's open. I think, you know, there's 12,000 words that I wrote in summarizing all the things up to the point. And it would take me another 12,000 words to write to continue what I'm going to do the rest of the day. And so to save a little time and to make it easier on keeping up with everything, what I'm going to do is just use the outline. All right? So I'm going to riff off of this quite a lot. A lot of this material is summarization from this text that was written by Holzapfel and Brown, called Between the Testaments from Matthew to Malachi to Matthew, and I augmented it with some of my own material and other sources. So, let's talk about Rome. Rome was a long time coming, and when it came, it was a long time remaining. And so, the Roman Empire is going to last centuries after its influence in the land of Palestine. And so you have Roman emperors going to reign for centuries. You're going to have the influence of Rome extending into the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries after the time of Christ. And so its roots go almost 500 or 600 years before the time of Christ. Now, it wasn't the exact same Rome that we knew during the 1st century, but it has roots stretching from its earliest days of inception till its final end, 1,000 to 1,100 years, depending on how you mark it. So Rome wasn't a fly-by-night empire by any means. You know, it lasted a long time and had a lot of influence. One of the things that we want to mention is that there was a lot of stuff that started before Rome rose to ascendancy in ancient Greece that impacted what's going to happen in Rome. So we mentioned this before, Greek influence in culture, in politics, in theater, and literature, and that sort of thing. A lot of that stuff that started was kept in force and continued to be followed by the Roman Empire that followed that. It wasn't identical, but they shared a lot of things. If you ever study mythology, Greek and Roman mythology, one of the things that you learn was for every Greek god, there was a Roman counterpart. And so they weren't all called the same names, but they had the same function. So even their mythical gods were parallel to each other. And so you have Olympus and Zeus, so you have different counterparts of different gods and so forth. And some of the practice of that mythology and the naming of that shows up in the context of the New Testament. When Paul and others came into the region of Lystra and Derbe and so forth, and they healed people there, they gave them the names of Greek gods, assuming that they were messengers come from God. So that kind of stuff that started in ancient Greek is going to be continued with a slightly different twist in Rome. So what Rome inherited in part culturally from the Grecians is going to affect how they dealt with the Jews. Now, we mentioned this already, and I want to mention it again because it's all going to come into play here. How conquering nations dealt with the people that they conquered varied from one nation to another. So the Assyrians, they were just mean, nasty, and brutal and beat everybody up, decimated the people, spread them all over the place, and never treated them very fair. And that's somewhat of an overstatement, but that's a generalization enough that's true. The Babylonians, when they took the children of Judah, the southern kingdom in the captivity, they didn't allow them all to go back home, but they allowed them freedom within the land of Babylon. You can worship, you can do whatever you want, you can plant crops, do all kinds of stuff. You'll still be our servants, but you can do pretty much what you want as long as you're here. When Cyrus, the Persians, released them and allowed them to go back home, they had the same freedom to do whatever they wanted, only this time they could do it back in their own homeland. But you are not under your own control. So we brought up the issue of self-rule, sovereignty, or autonomy. You are back in your homeland doing whatever you want to do, but you don't rule yourself. We are still kings. We have satraps and governors and other, you know, administrative officials to deal with that. So how Rome deals with other nations is going to be critical going forward. So you've got an empire that's all over the place. All right, and how they treated people in other nations is going to be critical from the standpoint of management of time, resources, money, and effort. So if you are a very powerful entity, the Roman Empire, you know, concentrated power immediately where you are, and then as your borders spread and you take over other countries, whatever, who's going to manage all of that? All right, one of the things that's big in software and in industry is scalability. Oh yeah? You can manage a company of 10, 100, 1,000. What happens when you get to 10,000 or 100,000 employees? I was listening to a commercial by Geico yesterday. They sponsor an ad on NPR affiliate in Nashville, and it was a Geico commercial. And Geico, of course, talks about government employees insurance corporations. So they started talking about one of the largest departments in the government being the Department of Justice. And I was stunned to find out that the Department of Justice worldwide, I mean nationwide, has like 120,000 employees. I'm thinking, that's a lot of people. just in the Department of Justice. And then it said, well, here's what most of them are. Most of them are guards in penal institutions all around the country, federal institutions. 18,000 plus federal guards that are part of the DOJ. Excuse me?
That's not counting probably your private entities.
No. This is just DOJ stuff. And then they said the next highest one were criminal investigators. That was 14,000. So 30,000 people. I'm thinking, that's just, the numbers just staggered me. All right? So my point is, what's this got to do with Rome? Nothing other than size. You've got people all over the empire. How do you manage those people? So they had to develop a management system that's going to incorporate some sense of sanity for Rome and for the nations that they conquer. And how this is going to spill out over the next few centuries and so forth as it impacts the land of Palestine is going to be critical as to who did what and why in the land of Palestine. They're still under Roman control, but Rome doesn't want to be in so much control that they have to send endless resources there. We lived in Puerto Rico a number of years ago when we first got married. And after we were there for a few months, a member of the church who was an agricultural economist from the University of Missouri, member of the Body of Christ, he was on a sabbatical, a Sabbath year from work. And during his sabbatical, he was doing work for the Department of Agriculture, and he was traveling all around the United States and American protectorates and so forth, like Puerto Rico was, just doing agricultural economic surveys. And so we met with him, he went out to dinner with him, had him over the house and stuff, and he was telling me things that just, wow, I didn't know that. So Puerto Rico is an interesting place, right? It's about 1,000 miles off of Florida and whatever, and 90% of the goods that are consumed there have to be flown in. I'm thinking, oh, how do you handle that? You know, it's just, it's about 100 miles wide. It's about 30 miles north and south, roughly, and it's an incredibly fertile place, but they don't grow a lot of produce there. And so most of the stuff that they consume has to be brought there from somewhere else. So that's an interesting dynamic. How do you manage that? That's just one island, all right, of a few million people, not dismissing them, and that's, you know, not the biggest. Well, Rome's dealing with lots of islands all over the Mediterranean, lots of countries all over the Mediterranean, and how those people are sustained. So what Rome did not want to do was to be involved in managing other countries that was going to cost them dollars and cents. So somehow or another, those countries had to maintain some sense of maintaining what they needed without Rome having to pay for everything. So that's a dynamic that's going to come into play. And how you maintain different cultures, different languages, different belief systems, all of this that Rome is going to get into starts with how Greek managed different people. So let's talk some more about that. So let's talk about the development of the Roman government. Initially, remember, we said that what was Rome started in the city of Rome, grew throughout the Italian peninsula and grew through areas beyond that, across the Mediterranean, Western Mediterranean, and Eastern Mediterranean. And so it has roots going hundreds of years before the time of Christ. It has roots continuing, that is, its produce hundreds of years on the other side. And so it became initially ruled by kings, like many nations were. And over time, the kings were advised by a council referred to as the Senate. We have a body of representatives in the United States, the House of Representatives, that is population-centered, and then the senators that are determined to per state. And so that name comes from the Roman Senate. So this council that was assisting the kings was in part determined, guided, and supervised by representative of leading families. Now, I want you to notice this. We're going to use a number of terms. They're going to talk about classes of people. And the classes of people that we're going to address are going to emphasize political influence on the part of those people who are already politically or economically or connected by means of nobility. And so if you were a noble of some kind, you had a title of some kind, you had an estate of some kind, you had a big business or something, if you were influential in some way, mostly politically and economically, you were probably a part of the Senate. All right. So to be a senator, I mean, even in the Star Wars movies, they make reference to the senates and the councils and that kind of stuff. generally speaking, it was the nobles that were involved in this. And so there's a term that's used called noblesse oblige that talks about the obligation of those who are noble citizens to help those people who aren't noble. And usually it's people who have money trying to tell people who don't have money what to do. So there's a hierarchy there. And it's a class-oriented structure based primarily upon wealth and influence. So that's what's going on. So there's a long-standing tradition of nobles and the Senate and aristocracy, that's the nobility, and oligarchy. Oligarchy means rule by a few. When we refer to oligarchs now, almost every time you hear it, it's Russian oligarch. What does that mean? It means, you know, you've got a few of these guys in control of everything. So it's talking about limited power, or power, expansive power, concentrated in the hands of a limited few. And so this is part of where Rome was centuries before, and that's going to change, and the dynamic of its change and how it spells out with reference to the consequences that's going to impact the other nations that they control, the land of Palestine in particular, is going to be interesting. So it was primarily ruled by kings with this kind of system in place, and this is a very, very, very quick overview. There's much more to it than this. We don't have the time to go into all the intricacies of ancient politics in Rome. But later it's going to develop into a republic. What does that mean? It's going to move away from the rule by a few to the rule by many. And so you come into the people ruling, and they're ruling by representative rule rather than a few people telling everybody what to do. All right, so that's going to change. Now, that's in part influenced by the Greek city-states that were the early advocates of democracy. And democracy, generally speaking, means the people rule. All right, so we have that as part of what we do today, supposedly. That is the government of the people, by the people, for the people. All right, so who runs the government? Well, we like to think that the government is not us sometimes, but technically speaking, yes, the government is supposed to do the bidding of the people. Now, we're not going to get into to what we think about that, but that's the idea. The idea is one guy or a bunch of guys don't control because they have power of some kind. It's distributed, and ultimately the people are going to make decisions. So that's part of their history as well. The motive here is to protect their independence by getting more people involved who are vested in it. All right. There are a number of companies that are public companies, which means that they're not owned by an individual. There are a number of companies that are privately owned, which means that they're owned by a limited group of people. And then there are some companies that are owned by the people who work there. They're employee owned. There are insurance companies, for example, that are referred to as mutual insurance companies. What does that mean? It means everybody who has insurance owns part of the company. All right? And so that's part of the beast that they bring into what's going on here. So we want everybody to have an equal share in how we're doing stuff. That was the mindset. And again, some of these things were developed according to ancient Greeks, philosophy and politics. So in this particular time, you had those people who were patricians. That's like the aristocracy and so forth that we mentioned before. These are people who were privileged people. And then you had the plebeians. Who were those? Those are the common people. So you've got a class structure. You've got the people who have and the people who don't have. Usually power versus non-power, riches versus lack of riches. So you still have this class system that's going on, but that's going to be challenged so that later people who are less wealthy still have as much say. All right? Who gets more say? Well, the people who control everything have all the bucks they get to say. Well, they're going to change that. All right. So the idea of an ethical system where everybody's equally represented is going to develop over time in Rome, in part due to what's going on in Greece. And that's an oversimplification of thing. Greek philosophers often said that everybody needs to be represented and that even the least of people has to be lifted by what decisions are made by everybody else. So the rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing. So the patricians nominated the Senate, and the Senate controlled all the elected officials. And so there's still a way in which those people were in power controlled other people in power. And so the executive branch determines the federal judiciary that are appointed for life, and they fill hundreds and hundreds of seats. So those people aren't voted in, but we vote the people in who make those determinations. So there's still, it's not pure democracy, but it's heading that direction. So notice, initially, the patricians, that's the privileged people, originally dominated, but later, the people who didn't have everything, they revolted, and they gave more power to others. And so there was a power-sharing thing that came to be simply because the people who controlled everything could make everybody do what they wanted to do, and enough revolts and rebellions took place that the commoners got more say in how things were done. So we're going to have several slides about the Romans are coming because this is how Rome did what they did where they were and how they're going to deal with things in far outreaches of their empire. And that's going to affect what's going on in the New Testament. So over time, there was a sense of plebeian, that's the commoners' equality. And so they granted citizenship to lots of people who didn't have wealth or power, or political clout and influence. Now, this is interesting. Remember, when Paul was about to be beaten by Roman soldiers, he said, "Are you going to beat me, a Roman citizen?" Where was Paul from?
Tarsus.
Tarsus, not Rome. Well, how's a guy, Jew, born in Tarsus, not Palestine, neither of which are in Rome, how did he come to be a Roman citizen? Because the Romans allowed citizenship among others who weren't the ruling class. And so citizenship became a way in which people were investing in the company. And so this is totally off subject but related. But have you ever been to a business where the person waiting on you in business obviously didn't own the business? Right? So here's the classic story that everyone likes to tell. After church one day when we lived in the greater Philadelphia area, a bunch of people coming over the house, and she calls a Little Caesar's pizza place, and she orders six pizzas. And the lady says, "I can't make six pizzas, it's too much." And Evelyn's thinking, "You're in the pizza business, what are you talking about? This is not telling people how to run their business, but all those things are automatic ovens. You put a pizza on, it rolls through, it does everything. You pretty much put the stuff on the pizza and it goes through." She says, "I'm here by myself, I can't do it." And so Evelyn says, "What's going to happen if six people come into the store and each of them wants a pizza? What are you going to do?" So she called another owner of another business, and he said, "That's an employee. There's no way that somebody who owned the business would ever do that. What's the point? An employee's not invested in the business." One of the members at Dahlonega manages a rack room shoe store. And most of the people work there are working there to earn money that they have a particular goal in mind to fill. And once they get it, they don't want to stay there. They're not invested in that. Rome wanted more people invested in their enterprise. And so they shared power in this way, or shared vestiture in this way, by granting citizenship to other people. And it made people happy. All right? So a Roman soldier, after he retired, could be declared a Roman citizen and get benefits, right? They had communities and retirement places that took care of Roman soldiers. That's part of what's going on in Macedonia when we talk about what's going on in the city of Philippi, named for Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great. So Rome is going to start doing things as they're spreading to enable them to run their empire more smoothly. And it's the smoothness of the empire and how it's run that's going to dominate why things are done during the time of the New Testament John and Jesus. So they're going to grant citizenship to others. People who aren't Romans or aren't Italians could become citizens, including soldiers. So as the growth of the empire grows and they conquer a nation, they allow people who are from Tarsus, like Paul, to not only be a citizen of where he's from, but also to be a Roman citizen. What does that mean? You are granted privileges. What's the particular privilege that Paul pulled when he called his Roman citizenship card? "You can't just beat me. I'm a Roman citizen." And the guy who holding his head says, "Listen, I had to buy my citizenship. I paid for it." And Paul says, "I had it from birth. I was born that way." Now, this is interesting. Herod, whom we're going to get to in a little bit, wasn't born in Rome. He wasn't born a Roman citizen. But he was declared by the power of Rome to be a citizen, which applied to him and all of his family. And so citizenship's a big deal in the Roman Empire. Paul used it, and the soldier to whom he was speaking said, "I had to buy mine." And so this is going to affect how they're dealing with other people. It's placating people. It's saying, "We're on your side. You've got a special membership card. You are a member of the Roman Empire." And I'm not trying to diminish it. I'm simply saying this is one of the things they did to manage what's going on. Everybody gets a share in the company. All right? Everybody gets a share in the empire. So conquered people retained indigenous culture. That means they kept doing what they were doing. Rome did not want to do what Antiochus IV did, forcing everybody to adopt one religious system. Rome said, we don't care what you do as long as you don't cause any trouble for us. Watch that again. We don't care what you do as long as you don't cause us any trouble. That's all they wanted in Palestine. The reason why Jesus was so concerning to others was they were afraid that the Romans were going to come and it's going to upset everybody's apple cart. You could do whatever you want, but don't do something to bring the wrath of Rome upon us. Just don't do that. All right? So conquered people retained indigenous culture, and because of that, they were part of Rome. They joined Rome. They may not have all the official sanctions that Rome would give to everybody, but nonetheless, they were protected because they were under the aegis, the auspices of Rome. Others were bound to Rome, watch this, by treaty, and Rome provided troops. They had arrangements with them. And so this is not at all to compare the United States to the Roman Empire, but we have treaties with lots of people. And one of the things that we do is we provide military support, and we provide economic support and arrangements. So Rome offered to protect a lot of people. They did that for Judea during the time of the Maccabees. We're going to see three brothers, Judah, for whom the name Maccabee came, and then his brother Jonathan and Simon. All of them made trips to Rome, said, we want you to protect us. All right? So the Judeans had treaties with Rome. So they were already under Roman protection when Herod's going to come on the scene and when Pompey goes there, all right? They are already having a connection with Rome. So that goes back a long time before Herod came on. So they expanded all over in the West, all right? They conquered states that were governed by Roman magistrates. They maintained peace, they collect taxes. But now they're going to expand the other direction. Eastern Mediterranean. So when we say east, we're not talking about far east, we're talking about the Mediterranean. Where Italy was, you know, the big boot hanging down, they went west towards North Africa and other places in Spain and Gaul and England. Rome had influence there. That's the western expansion. But east is going the other direction. Go to Asia Minor, Turkey, the areas that we know to be Babylon, the land of Palestine and so forth, and even Egypt. And so that eastern expansion is going to come later. And so there's a hesitancy to be involved in this because we are already stretched pretty thin. All right. It used to be said the sun never sets on the British Empire. Why? Because Britain controlled places all over the surface of the globe. All right. It's not what it used to be. So how do you manage that? Well, they didn't manage it forever because a lot of places are now independent of Great Britain. All right. Canada is now independent of Great Britain. And many of the places in the Caribbean that used to be under their control are now independent of them. Why? Britain couldn't manage that forever. So how is Rome going to do the same kind of stuff that Great Britain did in more recent centuries? How are they going to control all these things? Well, there was a hesitancy to get involved because they had to have a management system. So the other thing was, at this point in time, Roman generals were kind of independent. They were generals. They had armies. And they kind of did whatever they wanted to do. And in some far-flung places of the expanses of the Roman Empire, Roman generals demonstrated they were a little bit too opportunistic, and they were after their own glory and their own riches. So we've got these guys that are kind of renegades. They're Roman generals, but they're out there where we can't manage them, and who knows what they're doing. We've got to have a way that we can manage things equitably that are good for us. So continuing this, they establish provinces that are going to be under their control, and they become client states. So you are my client. You're not equal to me. You're my client. I'm here to serve you, but I'm getting something from you. All right? So their independence wasn't total. They were semi-independent. All right? When you get older, sometimes you go into a place called assisted living residence. What does that mean? You can do some stuff, but you can't do everything. And there's usually a range of things that they determine how independent you are. There's 7 or 9 tests. And if you can't do so many of them, they say, well, you need help. And you can't do more of them, then you see you need lots of help. You got to go to full-blown nursing care, all right? We're not talking about nursing care. We're talking about, can you function as an independent nation? Not so much. Well, we will help you, but you got to do some of this stuff yourself. And so how far is Rome going to help them? Well, what can you do? I'm not going to do for you what you can do. I had a brother ask me something to do something once, and it involved a little bit of tech work. And he says, can you do this for me? And I asked him, I said, is there any reason why you can't do it? He goes, no. I said, then I don't know. I wasn't trying to be mean, but Rome's going to say, I'm not going to do for you if you can do this for yourself. All right? And so Rome wanted some degree of independence, so they didn't have to do everything. So we mentioned already Roman generals are opportunistic, and that's a problem that developed. So over time, the development of Rome changed so that there is a third class. Now, when you see the term equestrian, that's almost always used with reference to something to do with horses. Well, it developed because those people who were involved in the cavalry were involved in the army that they were horsemen. And so the term equestrian developed between the privileged and the plebes. And some of these guys, because they were soldiers and because they were businessmen, they were a middle class. Not poor, not rich, but they had more than the poor, but not as much as the rich. Well, they also wanted to be sharing in the power. All right? So the wealthy, non-political, that's this class, former soldiers and businessmen, what's interesting is because of their soldiering experience and their business experience, they ended up being perfect for the tax collecting business. Why? Because they had authority from soldiers, and some of these guys were in business, and so they established means by which money's going to be collected. Remember, Antiochus Epiphanes IV ran into a problem when he was defeated, and part of the cost he had to pay was to surrender lands to the Romans. And when he surrendered lands, he lost income. And not only did he lose income, he had to pay tribute to the Romans for their protection. And in order to do that, he had to get money from somewhere else. That's one of the reasons why he went around robbing temples. That's one of the reasons why he went around selling favors to people. Oh, you want to be an ex? You give me some money and we'll make that happen. And so these people are going to be the means by which financial equality, or financial stability, I should say, not equality, is going to be managed in the Roman Empire. So that's what they're going to do. So they develop a professional army. Now this is interesting. Rather than having a bunch of ragtag people who are just volunteers, incidentally, this is an issue during the Civil War, this is an issue during the Revolutionary War, some of these guys who were battling as soldiers were farmers, and they'd only join battles part-time. What did they do the rest of the time? They went home and took care of business. All right, they took care of what they needed to do. So they weren't on the field all the time. They didn't have the money to pay everybody. So some people would work for a month and they'd go to the battle for a month. And so you've got this ragtag kind of a volunteer thing going on. And over time, they developed the idea to have a professional army whose full support came from the Romans. Now, how's that going to be managed? All right, got to have some dollars and cents to do that. In addition to that, they provided minimum benefits for them, and promised them Roman citizenship and retirement when they concluded. And so this is one of the things that was a biblical thing that Jesus dealt with. When a Roman soldier compels you to do something, you do what he asks and do double. All right? Roman soldiers had that privilege that they could ask people to do whatever was needed. You have to carry their stuff. You have to tote their baggage, whatever. And so the professional army that's going to develop is going to have to be sustained. Remember, when the children of Israel during the time of Samuel wanted a king, and Samuel was upset, God said, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Samuel said, you know what it's going to cost you? He's going to take your sons for an army. He's going to take your children to manage things. They're going to be cooks and they're going to be all this. He's going to derive taxes from you. It's going to cost you a lot. And they said, we don't care. We want a king to fight our battles. All right? They were going to have to pay for it, but they were willing to pay for it to have a king. So how are you going to pay for this? Somebody somewhere is going to cough it all up. All right, and so there had to be a means to collect money to support the growth of the empire, the management of the states, and all the infrastructure, the aqueducts, the waters, the highway system, all that kind of stuff that was everywhere. That's going to cost some dollars and cents. So Rome had to be in the management business. So rather than allowing generals to be loose cannons that ran all over the place, they allowed the generals to have more power and gave them benefits. Now, over a period of time, things are going to change in a very dramatic way. There's a general by the name of Julius. We know him better as Julius Caesar. And he's out, one of the renegade generals, conquering stuff all over the place. And people said, we need to rein this guy in. He's getting very powerful. Well, he realized that that was a threat to him. And he came, and Julius, who was a Roman general, conquered the city of Rome. Not the Empire of Rome, but the city of Rome, and took control of the Senate. That's not what they wanted to happen. But that's what happened. And so there's going to be a dynamic shift roughly 3/4 of a century before the time of Christ and what's going on. And so he took control of everything. He rebuilt Rome, helped the poor, gave outsiders self-rule, built the library and all kinds of stuff. But he's going to be killed. All right, so the Ides of March, March 15th, 44, he was killed. It's, see if I can get this right, Veni, Vidi, Vici. He said, I came, I saw, I conquered. All right, that's what he said. Everything I saw, I took. And so Julius did something that nobody else had done in taking over Rome single-handedly, so to speak, with his armies. But he's murdered, all right? So what's going to happen out of this? You got this very popular guy that takes over Rome and conquers the Senate. But Julius has an appointed guy that's going to follow him, and others with him go after those who murdered his uncle. And this 18-year-old kid, his nephew, is called Octavian, or Latin Octavius, who's later given the name Augustus. If you open your Bibles and turn to Luke chapter 2 and start reading, you're going to see his name. He is the first full-blown, empire-wide, recognized emperor. Well, why do I say it that way? Julius is sometimes referred to Caesar, but he didn't get to do what the other guys did because he was just getting started. And so sometimes people refer to him as the first of the Caesars, but his control was rather small compared to what it's going to be later. Later, his nephew, starting with Augustus, then Tiberius, Claudius Caligula, and all the rest of the guys through dynasty and so forth, and then changing when Vespasian becomes king, they're going to be worldwide controllers, all right? So he's succeeded by Octavian. So Octavian, who's going to later be called Augustus, the name August, the month comes from them. To be an august person means to be a person in control. It's a reference to being august or reverenced, respected, all those terms. It's an issue of authority. It's a title. So aided by Mark Antony, who was Cleopatra's husband, Octavian defeated the people who murdered Julius. And there's a triumvirate. The first one was Julius Pompey, the general that we mentioned before in Crassus. And then there's the second one, which is Octavian, Mark Antony, and Lepidus. So they're going to take control. And what's going to happen here is Octavian, later to become Augustus, that's the name, title that was given to him, he becomes the sole ruler of Rome. And he becomes the sole ruler of Rome with the Senate and everybody in Rome going along with this. So initially they wanted a government that was kind of evenly distributed among the people. Initially two classes of people, and then three classes of people, allowing citizenship throughout the empire. But because of the way Julius was able to manhandle things, they saw that it was beneficial to them to allow a single person to have a lot more power than they had before, and we'll work with that. So what's interesting is, for the next 100 years plus, there weren't any wars in Rome. There weren't warring generals in Rome. We're going to see some conflict, but not on the scale it was before. And Rome is at peace, and that's what's called the Pax. That's the Latin term for peace, Pax Romana, which means peace of Rome. And what's that got to do with anything? It's got everything to do with what's going on in the land of Israel, because they wanted that maintained. You got to keep peace. I don't care what you think. I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you do, but you got to be peaceful. Right? That's it. So it's the mindset that we mentioned before about the French have. We don't care what you do, we don't care what you believe, but when you come here, you are us. You are assimilating. And so everybody's going to have to assimilate in this. Right? They didn't force any particular religion on anybody. They didn't force any particular practice on anybody, but they did enforce anything that's going to disrupt the empire. So anything that's going to smack of violence or potential violence, they're going to go crazy about stopping. And that's why people were so concerned about what Jesus was going on. So during this period of time, after about 100 years of war, they're going to have 200 years of relative peace. So the Senate declares Octavian Augustus Princeps, which means you are the king, you're the emperor, you are the ruler. So the Senate conferred that upon him. So even though he's the sole ruler, the Senate still has power. The Senate's the one who's going to declare Herod to be the king. So, citizens lost some rights, but they gained a lot, all right? We've got this whole issue about personal freedom. Are people willing to let all their information out in the world so every company in the country and around the world can use it? Well, as long as I've got some degree of freedom, I don't care what they know about me. And so we surrender some rights in order to secure more freedom. So that's part of what's going on. They gain civil freedom, order, stability, and prosperity. And this is, again, don't want to get into politics, but in some European governments, the taxation level is absolutely incredibly high. Well, why would anybody be subjected to that? They don't have any other cost. They don't have to pay for any benefits. It's all given. Cradle to grave life insurance and cradle to grave health insurance, cradle to grave everything, guaranteed jobs, guaranteed minimum amounts of money. And people said, well, that's all, that's a political system I'm not comfortable with. My point is, people were willing to surrender their dollars and cents and lose some rights so they'd have a greater sense of freedom. Part of that, and I'm not saying they're equated, but the idea is the same, they were willing to give that up. So Rome is going to maintain control. You'll get everything you want to be free, but we're still going to be in control. So what happens? During this time, Judea became a Roman protectorate. So I brought up Puerto Rico before. It's not a state. It's a territory governed by the United States, like is Guam and like some of the other things, the U.S. Virgin Islands and so forth. They're not states, but we are protecting them. That started, notice the date, 164 B.C. That's 101 years before Pompey came to solve and to resolve, the conflict between Aristobulus and his brother Hyrcanus. Aristobulus II, Hyrcanus II. And so 100 years before that, Judas, and I just abbreviated as Judas Maccabeus, he arranged an alliance with Rome. All right. So the alliance he made with him was Judea was at that time a rebelling faction. And as long as you don't rebel against us, you keep it in-house, we'll watch out over you. So that's the first alliance. It's renewed 20-some years later by his brother Jonathan. Judas is now dead. And now he is in league with the Seleucids, right? And so he's not a rebel faction. He's got an alliance going on with them. But he renews the protectorate. He goes to Rome and gets this. Simon, the last of the five brothers, these are the three critical ones that we know. Simon's the last one, the five brothers or sons of Matthias. He goes to Rome and he renews this protecting treaty arrangement. But now, during this time, Judea is independent. Remember, they drove everybody out. They killed everybody who opposed what they were doing. They drove the Seleucids out. They drove Antiochus' men out. They got rid of all the people who weren't what they wanted them to be, and they established themselves as both kings and priests. And Rome still's got a treaty going with them. You don't do us no harm, we'll take care of you. All right? So what's about to happen in Roman influence in the land of Judea has a history that stretches back at least 100 plus years in which Judea sought Rome's influence. All right? Some of it they sought and didn't want when Pompey came and took away what they had for 100 plus years. But they were still protecting themselves. Again, there's a trade-off. We'll give you X, but let us have our say about this. Okay? So what does it mean? They're under somebody's thumb. All right? Wasn't the kings like David and Saul and Solomon, but they still had some degree of independence. So Rome told people around Judea, leave those people alone. All right? I'm the big guy on the street. That's my friend. Don't touch my friend. All right? That's oversimplified, but Rome, in effect, says we are watching after these people. All right? They're our people. We are protecting them. All right. So when this dispute sprung up later, these are the sons of Janaeus and Salome of Alexander, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. They're vying for each other. Remember, one took control and the other one drove him out. The other one took his wife and kids hostage and whatever. And there's a fight. They're going on. They're enlisting each other to come to their defense. They both want to be both priests and kings. All right. So what did they do? They called both of them, said, let's get the Romans to come in and resolve this for us. Who do they call? Pompey sends an ambassador first, and then Pompey comes himself. He says, I'll make this decision. And while he's in the decision-making process, Aristobulus says, who cares about that guy? I'm going back to Jerusalem to take control. Well, that just ticked Mr. Pompey off and said, no, that's not going to happen. I'm siding with Hyrcanus. So civil war broke out between Roman armies helping Hyrcanus and those in defense of Aristobulus. They were hiding in the temple. The Romans marched into the temple, violated everything. They took Aristobulus and took him into captivity. All his people are slaughtered, and Hyrcanus is going to become the high priest, but he doesn't have civic political power anymore. Pompey says, I'll put a Roman here to do that. Watch that. What the Hasmoneans had for 115 years was lost when Pompey came on the scene. You can be the priest, but you're not going to tell people what to do militarily or politically. Rome's going to do that. And from that point forward, they had lost what they had for 100 plus years. And Herod's going to come on the scene pretty soon. Hyrcanus is the victor, Aristobulus is exiled, and 12,000 people died in that uprising. Judean independence was lost after approximately 80 years. Where did it go? Roman control. Roman control. Now, they still had treaties and asking Rome to look over their shoulder and watch them, but they still did it pretty much everything. They didn't have to ask Rome for any permission to do anything. Now, they don't do anything without Rome's influence. This is why the Jews want to put somebody to death, got to ask the Romans for permission. Where'd that come from? Goes back 63 years before the time of Christ. So 100 years later, when they want to put Jesus to death, Jews can't do it. Why? You may run the priesthood, you may run all the religious decisions, but that's a civil, governmental, political authority. You need our permission. That starts 100 years before. What are the consequences? The Hasmoneans, that's the Maccabeans, lost power, lost influence. They lost territories. They didn't have control over Samaria like they had before. And this is part of why Samaria and the Samaritans weren't regarded very well. They were considered half-breeds. They weren't totally Jews. They were influenced by all kinds of pagan stuff. And besides, we don't control them anymore. So people, in order to avoid them, would cross over the Jordan River, go up on the other side of the east, and come back into Galilee to totally escape going through Samaria. Jesus didn't buy into that. And so that's part of the tension that's there. They were placed under Roman control, that is the land of Judea, for Rome's interests. So they are not autonomous, they're not self-governing to the extent that they were before. This is all what the Romans are doing. So what are the consequences? Pompey dies. So in 63 BC, he sends an emissary and then travels there. And 15 years later, he's going to die. But Hyrcanus, the one whom he appointed to be the next priest, not the political leader or military leader, but the priest, had an advisor. His advisor's name was Antipater. Who's he? He's the father of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, that's the Herod that we're talking about, that rebuilt the temple and built it forever and ever, killed and slaughtered the innocents. That's the Herod that's in control when the New Testament opens up. His father was an assistant to Hyrcanus. Now remember, Hyrcanus was in the line of the Mattathias seed line. They were the priestly line, but there's no way we can prove whether or not they were part of the high priestly line. So there's an issue that's going on there. So Hyrcanus and his advisor, that's Antipater, they asked for Julius Caesar to help them. I just put Julius, didn't have room to get that on there. So Julius made Antipater the governor. So remember, Pompey determines who's going to do what politically, militarily, in the land of Judea. And so they ask for the input of Julius Caesar. He's still alive at this point. And Julius Caesar, he nominates and declares Herod's father to be the governor of the land. All right? Now, who was he? We're going to talk about that when we get into Herod. He was an Idumean, a descendant of Esau of the nation of Edom. All right? So now you have, remember, they were arch rivals, arch enemies for a long time. How did Jacob become Jacob? Jacob became Jacob because he took the place of his brother. Who was born first? Esau. He had the birthright. And Jacob was called Jacob because he came second and was a supplanter or took the place of. And so Esau, when he finds out what his brother's done, he says, he's done twice to me what his name says. He's stolen the birthright from me. Actually, Esau stole it, you know, sold it. That is the blessing. And then he's taken the actual birthright. And so Esau wasn't responsible for the prophecy made about him when his mother was told there's two nations in your womb and the older is going to serve the younger. Well, that's not the way it usually works. The older gets the greater inheritance, right? He gets double the inheritance. So he would get 2/3 and Jacob would get 1/3. And so Jacob, because he's conniving, because his mom is conniving, his dad doesn't hear very well, see very well, he's duped into giving the blessing to Jacob. And so Jacob and Esau become enemies. Jacob goes off and he's going to spend 14 plus years and then even more working with Laban, his father-in-law. And when he comes back, he's afraid of Esau. And so they become two nations. Esau becomes the land, the nation of Edom, and the Edomites and the Idumeans, another name for them. And Jacob, of course, becomes Israel. So this guy, Antipater, is a descendant from Esau. But now, a descendant of Esau is involved in governing the descendants of Jacob. So that's an interesting dynamic. And that play between how they get along is going to affect what's going on in the life of Herod, to say the least. So Julius allowed Hyrcanus to stay as priest, but he had limited political power. Where's the political power now? In the hands of the Idumean that he appointed, Antipater. And reminder, Antipater is the father of Herod the Great. So Herod the Great, he wasn't just picked out of nowhere. to become what he was going to be. His ancestry was involved in this. Antipas, his grandfather, Antipater, his father, they were involved in what's going on in the land of Judea. Some territory is restored, and Roman soldiers there withdrawn. Why? Because Antipater's going to see that everything's going to be on an even keel. And that's it. The less involvement we have, the better it is. We don't want to have to pour our resources into this, so you handle everything. That's Herod's job. That's Pilate's job. That's the descendants of Herod's job. Keep everything smooth so we don't have to send Roman soldiers here to take care of everything. Why? That costs time, effort, money, resources, manpower. So if you can keep everything going, we don't have to put into this. It's just like when one big company that manages lots of other companies, one of the things that they want is all those other companies to maintain their own checks and balances, you know. Can you make sure that your company's running good? Because we don't have to take money from this company to put in this company. Why? Because it upsets everything. Make sure everybody's paying their own way, carrying their own freight. And so if the nation could do that and maintain some degree of stability, Rome was cool. They didn't have to be there all the time. They didn't have to see what's going on. As long as everything was fine, they got a good report, they were okay with that. So when Julius died in 43, the son of Aristobulus established a kingdom. And this is interesting. He's supported by the Parthians, one of the arch rivals, enemies of Rome. He attacks, he captures Jerusalem. He kills Antipater. Antipater is Herod's dad. So Herod loses his dad, who was appointed by Julius Caesar to be the governor in this region. And he takes, Aristobulus, one of the sons of Aristobulus, imprisons Hyrcanus. He proclaims himself king of Judea. Now this is kind of a bold thing to do. There was prior Hasmoneans that did so, but this is a last-ditch effort. So, what's going to happen? 63 BC, Pompey comes, he brings Judea under Roman influence and control, and that's not going to go away for hundreds of years. All right. So because all the stuff that's going on with the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, and challenges from within and without, Rome's going to come in and puts an end to that. Initially, indirect, he takes control through Hyrcanus and Antipater, and later we see this revolt. Antipater's going to be killed and Hyrcanus is going to be deposed. And so the Judea becomes Roman clients. We will protect you. You are our client. We're responsible for you, which means you can't do this on your own. It's like you're a minor. If you're a minor, you can't sign documents on your own. You have to have somebody else sign them. Rome says you can't make decisions on your own. We have to sign these documents because you're a minor. So that's a nice way of saying this when it says they're clients. You're not independent rulers. This continued the initial relationship that started 100 years earlier when Judas Maccabeus said, "Protect us." His brother Jonathan said, "Protect us." His brother Simon said, "Protect us." And so Rome was looking out for what's going out for Judea a long time because of these treaties. So he just mentioned that. Judas Maccabeus continued that treaty by Jonathan and continued by Simon. Rome's influence is going to continue to grow. They started with Western domination. It's going to grow in the East. And so that's going to affect Judea and Jerusalem even more. Even more. Later, leaving its mark on New Testament history. And that's going to get us to where we're going to take up in the next hour. Herod, the son of Antipater, is going to come on the scene. And he is smack dab not only in the years preceding, about 30 years preceding the time of Christ and the New Testament, but he's going to continue to rule into the life of Christ and John. So we are now almost out of the period between the Testaments and into the New Testament itself. So we started, you know, on Thursday evening talking about the Jews coming out of captivity and starting the period of restoration. That's still Old Testament. And then when Alexander came on the scene, we are out of the Old Testament into the period between the Testaments. And all this discussion about the Maccabeans and their challenges and the impact of the Seleucids and Antiochus and the Hasmonean Empire, that's where we're about to get out of that and back in the New Testament. So we crossed out of the Old Testament, started there, crossed out of that, and we're at the very end of the period between the Testaments about getting the New Testament. So this is all impacting what we're going to see next. All right, we've gone a little bit more than I wanted to, 58 minutes. So let's take a break.